Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Hour number two of this Thursday edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Today is the 17th day of December 2015. It's a Thursday. Quick note, tomorrow we will be joined by Dr. Ted Breuer. It's going to be a fantastic show.
Oh, buckle up.
I don't want to miss it. He is also, his website is healthmasters.com. His book, Breakthrough Health, is an essential if you're in the, if you like the alternative health, the, you know, too many establishment doctors, the medical association, they are a for-profit business.
Yep.
And so,
well, so is Ted, but
right, so is the alternative health. But the established medical associations, you know, they don't want to cure disease. They want to keep you in that loop of continuing to get sick and need treatment, sick and need treatment. You don't even have to order anything from Ted. Contact them. Talk to them. Tell them what your issues are, and they'll go over everything with you. They're very...
They don't dispense medical advice. Please understand that. But he can direct you to the nutritional supplements that might help you, or, you know, dispense... I got to be careful how you say this.
Yeah.
Just contact him if you have any issues.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah.
All right. No medical claims. But anyway, folks, portions of tonight's broadcast brought to you by AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. It's not too late if you have somebody on your Christmas list that you want to really surprise, make happy. Hint, hint. No, I'm just kidding. You know, American Survival Wholesale is really, they've got everything. Go to AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. Folks, please prepare. Prepare for what's coming. We need spiritual preparation, of course, and we need practical preparation. On the practical prep side, you cannot go wrong with AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, Christian-owned, veteran-owned company. Also, Family Essential Oils. Yeah. Contact Katie Whalen, folks.
I got to tell you, we've had a weird season here in this fall where we've had very little snow. It's been very mild, and allergy season seems to be just... I see people all over the place suffering from allergies, and the essential oil that we've been using is the Breathe oil, and that thing is amazing.
We use it here in the studio. Well, in the office, is not in the studio necessarily, because it does, but in terms of the atomizer, whatever you call that.
Yeah.
But FamilyEssentialShop.com.
A whole array of different options of oils, and there's a book that explains what each one does and the benefits and whatnot.
Yeah.
Essential oils.
Family Essential Shop. Yeah, I can talk. FamilyEssentialShop.com. You can tell. You know, if I got paid for these things, they'd want their money back, right? No, I'm kidding around. Block and Pocket as well. You know, all of these. Go to HagmanandHagman.com and check out the various listings there. Everything there to help you. Block and Pocket. My goodness, what a great product they've got. Just tremendous. And if you have a cell phone, I don't carry a cell phone. I don't. I mean, if I have to, if I'm at a conference or something, I'll have a cell phone. It's really not mine, and I don't even know how to use it. So people just have to send me stuff, and, you know, like, they'll send me a text, and I look at it, and I don't even know how I got on there, but okay. Anyway, with your permission, folks, I don't have any way of really gauging how well the first hour went, except from my guys here, and of course, you know.
Like I said, I couldn't read through my PDF here. I was paying attention to what you were saying.
And this is it, because now we're getting really to the meat of the matter. And the first hour, basically, the preceding World War One and into World War One, setting the stage, the geography, the geopolitical part of the Middle East and what was called then the Levant, the Ottoman Empire. Because you'll hear alternative media, you'll hear the media throw around the term jihad, jihadist, jihadism. And they have no clue, or they don't want to research the depths of that term. So people think, well, this is back a 7th century artifact from the 7th century, a barbaric relic of the 7th century. Well, while that might be true, it's more true to understand it's more contemporary than that, that Islam as a religion was weaponized not by the Muslims themselves, but by the political powers that preceded pre-war World War I Germany and World War I Germany, and was refined thereafter during the Nazi rise of Nazis in World War II. So when you understand that, now the concept of Operation Paperclip and the Nazi ideology that has been imbibed, infused, and facilitated and is so rife today in this country, now you understand why Nazis and Muslims are so of kindred spirits. You see, the war, World War One, as I said, it proved disastrous for the Ottoman Empire, and the Muslims were really PO'd. Because the idea of jihad as a weapon that could be used by the non-Muslim Western powers, it failed in the eyes of the Muslims, but it certainly proved a good tool in the eyes of those who wanted to exploit them. Now, by in no means am I excusing Muslims at all. I'm just saying, when people say Islam is a religion, is a cult and is a religion of death and all that, yes, but don't stop, you know. And I can I want to say names, and I just thought, you know, I don't want, I can't, because don't stop right there. You got to understand why, because by itself, Islam, the components of Islam, the various factions, as I mentioned before, the Yazidis and Shiites and Sunnis and other factions, the Kurds, they'd be fighting among themselves and so busy that, you know, it's just it would implode. But you see the refinement and tapping all these disparate, all of these different groups on the shoulder and saying, hey guys, come here. Here's what we need to do. We need you guys all to get together and jihad against these countries. These are non-Muslim countries. They want to take you over. They want to rape your land and rape your wives and take your stuff. And that's what they're doing. See, Islam was already predisposed to this violence. This Nazi ideology really honed this global jihad. That's what's important. So, as Tsarist Russia fell into the Bolsheviks during the war, this created a new enemy, and that was this godless communism in the eyes of both the Nazi regime as well as the Muslims. This, coupled with the news that England and France betrayed the Arab revolt against Turkey by dividing up the Middle East between them, referencing the Sykes-Picot Agreement, to which there were no Arab signatories, as well as providing a homeland for the European Jews in Palestine, as set forth in the Balfour Declaration, to which were there no Arab signatories, meant that the European powers were once again intent on colonizing the Middle East, and the nefarious Jews were behind it all. That was the story told to the Muslims. Okay, you follow me? So the cosmic struggles against the struggle against the enemies of Islam was refined to the extent that it was now a struggle between Islam on one end and the Jews and Christians on the other. Okay, what began as a holy war against the European colonialism and the effort to remove the European powers from the lands of the Levant, Central Asia, the Maghreb, gradually was being transformed into a religious conflict. Or at least that's the way it was being presented. Once again, it would be Germany that would come to the rescue of the faithful. And I'm not talking about the faithful Christians. Enter a guy by the name of Max Max von Oppenheim. Okay. Invoking jihad was the idea of Max von Oppenheim, or Oppenheim, the German Abu Jihad.
Oppenheim.
How do you spell Oppenheim, like Mary Oppenheim.
Okay.
It was in late October 1914, before the Ottomans had entered the war, who sided with the Central Powers, that he designed this master plan fomenting rebellion in the Islamic territories of their enemies. That guy on your screen. That guy. That's Max von Oppenheim. Now, this I'm quoting from Wolfgang G. Schwentz, German Middle East Early Years was the publication. The man most often credited with having single-handedly created the idea of global jihad was an amateur archaeologist. That guy right there. He was an amateur archaeologist. He was born in 1860. He died in 1946. But he was one of that breed of late 19th century, early 20th century adventurers who, he just went after all these exotic. He went out to all these exotic places and went to ancient ruins and. He actually came from the Oppenheim banking dynasty. His mother was Catholic, but his father was a Jewish convert to Catholicism. Now, Nazis didn't quite like that combination of bloodline. He was a hybrid or mixed race, according to the Aryans. Now, early on, Max decided that he did not want to be a banker from the banker family, but wanted instead to travel abroad, and he did that first in the military and later as an archaeologist and adventurer in the years and even decades before the outbreak of the First World War. He considered himself an expert on Middle Eastern affairs, insinuating himself into various academic fields such as archaeology, and he studied ancient civilizations and so on. But most importantly, he studied Islam. He lived in Cairo for a number of years, where he actually in Cairo he kind of adhered to this cultural aspect of Islam, and he had this harem group of women, and he bought slave girls and on the market and on an annual basis. His exploits in that area became so well known that a liaison with another man's wife led her to being murdered by a jealous husband. Actually, the guy actually drowned his wife in the Nile. Okay. Going back in the early 1900s, and think about this. Now, he became like a celebrity in his native Germany, and he was known to all. I mean, this guy was like the Kardashian, you know, the male Kardashian of Germany. Okay. But he was like a celebrity in both Germany and Middle East, and most people took it for granted that the Baron. Now, he was known as the Baron. He was a spy for the German Kaiser, for the government. He was on very close terms with the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and later with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Now, Peter Lavenda talks about Oppenheim. When Oppenheim was 23 when he first visited Greece and Turkey, 2 years later in 1886, found himself in North Africa, where he began to engage in a type of serial monogamy that's practiced in many Islamic cultures. He really kind of refined this practice. In other words, marrying someone for a couple of months, divorcing him, marrying someone else, divorcing him, and so on. It is kind of weird. But he had a fascination with the Orient. It fueled his travels and intrigues for the rest of his life. In 1892, he began his first serious investigation of the Levant. He traveled to Beirut and Damascus and eventually into Cairo, where he eventually established his household. Ostensibly, he was there as an archaeologist. However, he also spent time as a kind of a government agent. So you got to look at this guy's kind of he's not quite what he seems to be. Think of it this way: the archaeological expeditions of this guy, Max von Oppenheim, gave him a legend, a story, a cover story. He traveled, for example, North Africa from Algeria to Tunisia to Libya, and of course Egypt. He just developed all sorts of contacts. He was kind of like the Chris Stevens of his time, except in archaeology. As the events began ramping up between Germany and Turkey, Oppenheim, his idea of a global jihad developed as a tool of the German military. He said, hey, wait a minute, we can use the Muslims over here, and all the Muslims, they're really kind of torped that, you know, what's going on around here, so we can use this in our favor, meaning Germany, and we can use the Muslims to we can have them organize a global jihad as a tool of Germany's military policy. Now, Oppenheimer had the Kaiser's attention at this point. He was actually named an official advisor to the Kaiser and supplied him with hundreds of reports every year on the situations in North Africa, which is the Maghreb and the Middle East. So it was with the Kaiser's approval that the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire was approached in October of 1914, as I mentioned earlier, with a proposal that he declare a jihad against the Kaiser's enemies, and thus sealing the relationship between Germany and the Ottomans during the First World War. Now, even though Germany had foreign colonies, they were largely in Africa. Now, all these colonial territories, there was a lot of them, okay? In fact, they covered probably 2 million in population combined. They were not considered Muslim territories, so the Kaiser could get away with pointing the Ottomans at other European powers who did have colonies in the lands where populations were largely Muslim. Germany had territories in the East Papua, and in some of the South Pacific Islands, but their populations were not Muslim. Italy, another player, ostensibly Germany's ally for the most part in the war, was nervous about the call to jihad against the enemies of Islam, and because they were in Libya at the time, and they were afraid that those living in this predominantly Muslim country, they were going to be, you know, would heed the call to arms and turn on them. So there was always this possibility that this was going to go sideways. And, well, what happened? The intelligence community has a word for that. It's called blowback. And what did we see in the 20th and 21st century but blowback? Remember Brzezinski, Mujahideen, Afghanistan against Russia? It's an intelligence operation. What happened? Sideways. Blowback. But during the time of the World War or World War One, the ploy actually may have not have worked at all, except for the fact that the Kaiser himself was a fan of the Middle East, a fan of Islam, and particularly a fan of Islam. And please understand that, because therein lies the rub between Islam and the precursor to Nazism. In fact, the Kaiser, and not too many people know this, and you, we have a picture of the Kaiser. You can put him up. I think it's the Kaiser was given the honorific title of Haji Wilhelm, and Haji is a term, as I mentioned about Johnny Quest, Haji is a term for anyone who attended the Hajj. So anyone named Haji, you can bet today, you can bet he attended the Hajj. I don't know about Johnny Quest's pal. I'm not sure.
Looks like a. That's a czar.
Yeah, that's him. All right, so the Kaiser and the Baron were really drunk on the same Orientalist fantasy of whirling, of this lifestyle of concubines and such. And anyway, but let's move forward. Well, I should mention this. Think of this too. This what happens later is you remember Lawrence of Arabia. Okay, he figures prominently in here, too, Lawrence of Arabia. But that comes later. But getting back to Max von Oppenheim, Oppenheim was convinced that the entire region that he called jihad, that he was rallying for jihad, would rise up in support of the Turkish-German alliance in response to the call of holy war. So this is important to remember, and that the Kaiser would thus have an easy time of controlling the Suez Canal and in the process develop very lucrative trade routes and business relationships with Constantinople and the East. They saw their own reflections in that shimmering oasis, desert oasis. You know how that the waves come up from the hot sands. Well, they're kind of like, oh, this is ours. Well, the fatwa was translated, by the way, into Arabic, of course. It was written in Arabic and Farsi and Urdu, as well as French, and it was done so for a very specific purpose. It was thus targeting not just the Arabs of the Levant and the Maghreb, but also the Muslims living in Persia, which is modern-day Iran, who were Shiites and who were living, and those living in India and Afghanistan. And this was truly intended to be a global jihad designed to summon warriors from the entire region that had been colonized by the French and by England and by Tsarist or by Russia. Isn't that interesting? Where are we seeing this today? You see, the fatwa translated into Arabic, Farsi, and Urdu, as well as French, thus targeting not only the Arabs of the Levant and of the Maghreb, but those Muslims living in Iran, modern-day Iran, who were Shiites, and those living in India and Afghanistan. This was intended to be a truly global jihad designed to summon warriors from the entire region. Hey, guys, come on down. Let's fight. Isn't that the template that was used by Zbigniew Brzezinski against Russia? Isn't that the template, really, that was used in the Arab Spring? Isn't that, doesn't this sound familiar? I suspect, I say it does. Now, as I mentioned before, I'm citing heavily from the work of Peter Lavenda. I'm citing Hitler's Legacy. I'm citing from the work of Peter Lavenda, Ratlines, also Empire Beneath the Ice by Steve Quayle, and several other open source publications, and some FBI documents that were released back in 2014, about, I think, 1,400 of them. Now, very quickly here, and then we can move on. And thank you, Joe, for your, you know, for allowing me to do this. Let me just my notes here.
Well, thank you for
But the other thing here, not the call to jihad that I mentioned, where it was not just embraced. It was not embraced by all Muslims. In fact, the Saudi princes, in particular, were not comfortable with this arrangement. They rose up in revolt against the Ottoman Caliphate, and this is what we have today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they were aided and abetted by the British government with promises of gold and independence. This revolt, or this is a revolt that made another archaeologist. Isn't that interesting about archaeologists, Max von Oppenheim? But here enter an archaeologist by the name of T.E. Lawrence, born in 1888, died in 1935. He was famous throughout the world, thanks partly to the public relations effort of American journalist Lowell Thomas. And guess who T.E. Lawrence was? Lawrence was a British intelligence officer with experience in the region, and with some Arabic language capability, who saw this Arab revolt a possibility to remove Ottoman rule from the Saudi Peninsula, and from there, the region generally. While the Ottomans were fighting these battles in the 19th century tradition, Lawrence understood that guerrilla war, the tactics of jihad against them, would be more efficient and more successful. His approach was kind of about asymmetrical warfare. Okay. It's not just limited to the context of a global jihad, but also in terms of the Nazi underground. So we had the English archaeologist Lawrence on one side of the conflict and the German archaeologist Oppenheimer on the other side, Lawrence favoring Saudis, Oppenheimer not, and they were each trying to convince their side of the righteousness of their respective cause and manipulating the situation and the trust of the Arabs and the service to their European masters. This is where we're coming from, and a post-war strategy that would have befitted no one but the Europeans. So they've used, so the what I'm saying here is the Muslims were dupes of war, pawns of war. That does not excuse their behavior. It does not excuse their ideology. I'm just telling you the political influence and why the signs that we see today, you know, the pictures that are repeated ad nauseum, why it explains these pictures. The jihad strategy did not work as intended. As we know, the German-Ottoman alliance was defeated in World War I, and the Ottoman Empire fell a few years later. It did sow the seeds of what would become this more articulated tool of Western foreign policy. Look at the map, okay? The map on the screen, if you're watching this on YouTube, you see... jihad, World War One, this alliance that was defeated, it sowed the seeds of what was going to become a much more articulated, much bigger, much larger, much grander tool of Western foreign policy, one that the Germans would revisit less than 20 years later when the war drums again were beating in Europe and vibrating beneath the sands of Arabia. You see, this Oppenheim, the Oppenheim concept of global jihad was nothing less than the weaponization of religion in the service of German territorial ambitions, and was a weapon that could be wielded with cold efficiency by those who had no religious sensitivity themselves. It didn't matter. They were Nazis, ultimately. This is a tool of war. This is a political tool. Hopefully, are you getting it now? Are you understanding that now? Are you understanding why we're at where we're at now? You understanding why when we say we're still fighting World War One, what we mean by that? Maybe now you can convince your Uncle Ned dinner table that this whole process, the entire Middle Eastern situation, is not simple, but it's rooted. It's not. I mean, that Islam has been weaponized by the Nazis, by the West, both as a tool against communism and colonialism, which is why it works so well with the Nazis. Okay. That brings us up kind of to the Second World War. You know, the Grand Mufti, by the way, going past World War One, the armistice that was signed in November of 1918 that ended the First World War. Of course, we understand, Ted Brewer talks about this, it was not this guarantee of peace. No. If anything, it set really the pieces up on the chessboard for even a greater conflict, which was World War II. The Treaty of Versailles was one problem. Of course, it was seen by many as unnecessarily punitive to Germany. This was not the place to go, at this point, I don't think, into that discussion. But the Arab revolt clearly had been betrayed, and it's not the first time. Yet, you know, Western intelligence goes to the Muslims in the Middle East, and they say, "Okay, you guys, we're gonna depose the dictator." I'm just throwing this out as an example. We're gonna depose the dictator Assad. Hey, we've seen this before, haven't we, my fellow Arabs? But this is what's going on. You see, this is what's going on. The template used during World War II or World War I that was refined by the Nazis in World War II is being used today by the globalists and by the power brokers in the West, as well as the Nazi ideology throughout the United States. And they are being betrayed. By the way, T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. So, how'd we do? Did we do that okay? All right. So, anyway.
Sorry for my pause. I am
responding to an
email, and I'm just about...
But one more thing here, and then I'm going to turn it over to... Because this is so important. If you look at... there was growing a resentment after all this. There was growing resentment by the Arabs. And I say Arabs, not Muslims, but Arabs. Over this whole process. Okay. In the area known as Palestine, there was this growing resentment against the presence of European powers and the perceived intentions, rather, of Jews to take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. That was a idea spread by the spiritual leader of the Palestinian Muslims, Hajj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and a friend of Max von Oppenheim. That really was the cause to the Palestinian violence back in 1929. Al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, born 1897, died 1974, was a native of Jerusalem, had served with the Ottoman army during the First World War. But after the war, he shifted his allegiance to Faisal and the notion of this pan-Arab empire. Faisal would be defeated in his aims in Syria by the French army, and that left al-Husseini delusioned with Arab internationalism. He left Damascus for Jerusalem, decided to explore a more nationalistic agenda in Palestine, in that area of Palestine. A riot that broke out between the Muslims and the Jews during the 1920s really kind of gave rise to Hussein is developing a form of government, ideological government. And this leads us into World War II, okay, because the Grand Mufti was really tight with, in fact, the Grand Mufti and Hitler. You can put that picture up on the screen there. There it is. There's the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem right there on your screen, okay, al-Husseini and Hitler. It was the Muslims and the Germans working together. The Germans going to the Muslims and saying, "Hey, here's what we need to do. Remember that jihad we talked about, and that you guys did in World War One. We need to refine this a little bit, make this a little bit better. Let me help you." That's Adolf Hitler talking to the Grand Mufti. Now I'm simplifying this because there's a whole lot of politics that are going on, but. Because that guy there, al-Husseini, was blamed by some British diplomats for fanning the flames of Muslim outrage against the British and the Jews. But, I mean, there are so many moving parts to this. It's just incredible. So we cannot oversimplify it. So because of the time, I'm not gonna do that. But see, what happens from here, is the Nazis actually had created divisions of Muslims. Did you get that? Isn't that interesting? The Nazis created divisions of Muslims, and the Muslims were some of the fiercest fighters and most horrendous fighters for the Third Reich. After the war, and this is important to understand, after the war, and this is where Steve Quayle really shines, in my view, and the researchers like Steve Quayle and Steve Quayle really shine. See, after World War II, many of the, and I don't have any images of this, but this is reflective, really. This is telling, this image of the Grand Mufti, this Islamic guy in Hitler, is telling. After World War II, many of the high-ranking SS officials and many of the high-ranking Nazi officials in the Nazi Party that escaped during World War II or were led out through the rat lines into Argentina, into the Middle East, converted to Islam. That's right, you heard me correctly. Now this is where Peter Lavenda shines, and we're going to have Peter on the show. Lavenda cites in his book, and let me grab this right here.
You are on a roll.
You think?
Absolutely.
Okay. Otto Scorzini, Hitler's favorite commando and one of the leaders of Odessa, and, he converted to Islam. Nazi propagandist Johann von Leers converted to Islam. Moved to Egypt to work for the Nasser regime after staying briefly in Argentina. Hans Ulrich Rudel, ace fighter pilot and one of the leaders of Odessa, converting to Islam. Eribert Heim, one of the many Nazis who converted to Islam, escaped to the Middle East after the war. This guy was a medical doctor who experimented on prisoners in the camps. He was one of the most wanted war criminals in the world. All these guys are converting to Islam. Now, here's the problem today. Here's the problem. Okay, so you got all
some
this.
Interesting questions.
Right. Guess what?
John Brennan?
Yes. But, see, you had the rat lines taking these Nazis out of Nazi Germany. In fact, Hitler escaped.
The sunken U-boat.
Well, there were actually 200. So after the U-boats, you mentioned that the U-boat commanders were told to all turn themselves in. Well, isn't it interesting? Because I think there were 46 that didn't. Okay, 200 did, 46 didn't, and. Some surfaced off the coast of Argentina after the 3 months surrendering there, saying, "Hey, okay, you know, just got the memo." All right. Well, here's the problem: the rat lines that Russ Dizdar talks about, and Steve Quayle talks about, and others talk about. Peter Lavenda talks about. In fact, he wrote a book called "Rat Lines," funneling the Nazis out of World War II Germany. And then notice I jump into World War II because of time. What happened was because Islam was used as a tool by the Nazis, and the Islam ideology and the Nazi ideology were so compatible, many of the Nazis converted to Islam, which also brings up the fact, well, what happened to Hitler? Because we know that many of the high-ranking Nazi officials that were not captured either fled to Argentina, but many fled to Indonesia, including but not limited to Jakarta, Indonesia. And isn't it interesting that in Jakarta, that's where Obama's folks spent some time, or at least his mother, right?
And
just saying.
And himself.
Just saying.
In all right. earlier speeches, he talks about his childhood years being spent in Indonesia.
Right. So, you have... Now, the History Channel will tell you, of course, everyone is thinking that Hitler escaped. Folks, again, I really would urge you to do this. If you're a history buff and you believe that you've been lied to about Hitler, his escape, or his death, that is, on April 30th, 1945, outside of the bunker, then it would do you well to search. Use a search engine and find the release documents, the 1,400-plus release documents on the Internet. They were just declassified back in 2014. Some are hilarious. It's like, you know, it's like
I've
Elvis
seen some
sightings.
Of okay. I read through a report, probably a couple hundred page report of, you know, we had intelligence people down there. We had citizens that were living down yep. there that would send, you know, notes.
Oh, you had people in New York
City.
Yeah, you had people in New York City doing the same thing.
All these, I mean, some of them seemed, you know, credible, and the government followed up on some of them, but some of them were just kind of ridiculous.
Well, what wasn't ridiculous was the fact that there were, and you, again, these are declassified and accessible to the public. For now, you can find a lot of information about Hitler himself. About what happened and admissions by Stalin at the Potsdam conference to FDR saying, hey, you know what? The guy's alive. Hitler's alive. He's gone. It was a body double that was burned outside the bunker. And, of course, the skull fragment that the Russians had was female, right? And none of the dental records matched the body double. And the bottom line is there's no body. Can we say with absolute certainty that Hitler escaped? No. But what we can say with absolute certainty that what was presented to us as evidence of Hitler's death was nothing of the sort. The couch that Hitler supposedly, you know, offed himself on with the blood stain. Nope. That was tested, I think it was in 2009, found to be different DNA or different... No, it was nothing. Zero. Nada. Or was it 2009 or 2012? I don't know. It was one of those years. But having said all of that, the interesting part of this is this Nazi ideology that weaponized Islam, and when you start taking a look at people like Henry Kissinger, Heinz Kissinger, and then you start looking on the internet, open sources, and you see these people saying, "Wait a minute, in fact, there was a long documentary about one of the Illuminati family members. It was a female talking about Heinz Kissinger, and about some of the experiments, and not with Kissinger, not by Kissinger, but in the same conversation about experiments done and some of the connections and such. Now all of this Illuminati stuff begins to make sense. Now the skull and bone stuff starts to make sense. And I.G. Farben, we hear about that, right? We hear about I.G. Farben and Prescott Bush and Trading with the Enemies Act and so on and so forth. We know about this. Yes, we know about this. So now... what's important, the reason I spent this time and the reason this is so important is because this now gives us context for what's going on today. Operation Paperclip, it was not just to suck up the knowledge from the Nazi scientists. No. It was to preserve, protect, and to propel the Third Reich. And that's the people believed that this was the race, this was the Aryan race, the not Aryan necessarily, only Aryan, but the pure race, that this was this ideology, this pure, genetically pure race by the Reich needed to be sustained. Hence Hyperborea, the empire beneath the ice, hence the rat lines, hence the perverse Nazism that has been infused into the culture of American power brokers here in this country and in the West, And you can see now that this same ideology that is a part and parcel to the New World Order, and some say communist, but I'm beginning to believe, wait a minute, yeah, part of it is communist, but the big real part is the Nazi. They don't get along. It's a clash of ideologies, but, you know, we have tales of the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, or the families, the two big families, or many of the 13, not exactly having a good time at it, and they're fighting, so they're different ideologies. So we can honestly say there are two separate larger ideologies at play, or at work here, or at odds here. So the bottom line is all of this, why do we talk about all this? Who cares? It's ancient history. No.
Nope.
It's today. What's going on, what happened back then, is happening today. And it's this ideology that is pervasive in this country. It is responsible for the anti-Christian sentiment. It is responsible for the anti-Semitic sentiment. It is responsible for the antagonistic feeling against the Jews in Palestine, because they were set up in this. The Jews were set up as much as the Arabs were turned on by the global powers. Okay? So when we talk about jihad, no, that it's not just merely a 7th or 6th or 7th century artifact of this barbaric religion, because it is, but it's not just that. It's a weaponized form of political conquest, and it's being used by the West, it's being used by the Europeans, it's being used by Israel, it's being used by all the globalists. And this same ideology is really part and parcel into our political structure here in America. What do you think?
Very informative.
All right. And I could go on. Obviously, I can go on for days. Now I just want to qualify this too, because we you got to understand. Look, not all Catholics, not all Muslims, not all Arabs, not all Indians, not all whatever, insert name here, identified with the mission, with the ideology of the Nazi Party. I'm not saying that, okay? But those who did were responsible for this jihad. The type of threat that the world faces today after the fall of the Soviet Union, for example, is less, and we all know this, it's not really from state actors, is it? No, it's from terror cells that are usually identified as ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Mujahideen or some sort of Islamic group, okay? And the type of terrorist activity we usually associate with this type of group is to be found in America in the 1920s and the 30s at the very edge. Remember what I said earlier about the anti-Semitism, the Nazi groups being founded here in this country between 1933 and 1941, over 120. Well, that's the anti-Semitic sword, this subcutaneous layer of this Arab/Nazi ideology that is the underpinnings of anti-Semitism and anti-Christianity. And you see the very people involved in this, especially the Muslims who the Islamic Nazi amalgamation here, and who comes to mind but maybe a certain CIA director, I don't know. Maybe some political figures, maybe some foreign policy advisors. You see, this is the basis for what we're seeing today. Does that make sense, everyone?
Yes, it does.
All right.
Yes, it does. And we have...
I'm sorry I dominated all that, but...
It was definitely informative, and it was important and worth it. I needed to hear a lot of what you were talking about.
Well, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and perhaps we can do a series on this, because this is so important, because what we're seeing right now is the artifact, is the consequences, is the result of what we saw back in World War One. And you know, this is complex, but it's not. It's really simple. And this leads into, actually, this does kind of lead into the counterculture of the 60s and that whole, the formation of the Tavistock Institute, for example, the formation of all the secret societies. And again, I would urge everyone to go to if you're interested, read from, if you're interested in the Nazi side of things, Lavenda's book, The Hitler Legacy and Rat Lines, Russ Dizdar, Black Awakening. I'm sorry, I should have cited that too, because I got some of that stuff from Black Awakening. Lavenda's books, Sinister Sources, Steve Quayle's book, By Far, Empire Beneath the Ice. These are all the sources I cited. So, you see, I mean, but it goes deeper, because right now we are seeing the New World Order nugget that's seemingly communist. It's also got this Nazi, and I shouldn't say also, but it has this counterpart to it, this Nazi counterpart to it, which is that fascist counterpart. So, and the other thing I wanted to mention too, is Nathan and I were talking about this. You know, people are saying, "Oh, Trump, go." And yeah, you know what? If he's many people, I agree with what Trump is saying, right? A lot of what Trump is saying. But think about this: consider the fact that we are right now, domestically, we're ready for. If America was 1930s Hitler, if America was in 1930s Germany, we're ready for a Hitler. But we're in 2015 America, 2016 America, we're ready for a Trump.
Mm-hmm. Just like
be careful what you wish for.
After the 8 years of Bush and the wars, people were so ready to elect Obama because of the
One last thing. Yeah, you're right.
The difference.
One last thing. You see, why is Obama in office? Why did why did Bush and Cheney turn their heads when people were screaming, "Hey, he's not eligible, for crying out loud. We don't know who this guy is."
Well, maybe because Obama furthered the goals of Daddy Bush.
You see, remember what I said, and what the authors and researchers and the scholars and academics said, that Muslim was a weaponized tool of the Nazis. Look back at the lineage of the Bush family, right? Look back at the affinity of the Cheneys. Look back at the affinities of the Rumsfelds and the lineage there. And all of the people, the Wolfowitzes, the doctrines of those people. What do you see there? Well, is it possible? And in the case of Prescott Bush, obviously. And in the case of those associated with the companies like Ford and I.B. Farben and such, that they supported the Nazis? Well, what's the missing component there? The Muslim component, the Muslim tie. So how great would it be to have this charismatic Muslim affinity, you know, this guy, this Muslim, that's identifies with Islam, knows it well. So yeah, why should we object? Even though he's a Democrat, why should we object? Even though we don't know much about him, why should we object? Of course not. Wait, if he's going to advance their agenda,
you know, only the true individuals or powers that control the people who are on the political stage, they never change. Only the puppets change.
Right.
The agenda stays the same. The power behind the people, whether the money. And then the influence with the agenda, it's so deep and ensnared in our political system. Just reading an article the other day, they talked about how it has become basically not impossible, but the lines have been made so wide, I mean, so far apart, for an average citizen to be able to become a member of the Senate or a House of Representatives member.
Yeah.
You know, you need millions of dollars just to run
you need a
campaign.
You need some juice, baby.
So you have Trump, who has his own money. He doesn't need campaign contributions from anybody.
Makes him dangerous.
What is that? I mean, what is he?
I mean, dangerous. Is it political system?
Personal ambition that is driving him? Is it an actual love for country to transform America back into the republic it once was, which we know can't and won't happen?
Yeah, why?
Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, and human nature plays a big part in this.
Right.
Ego.
Right.
If somebody were to get that power, would that change the person? And you, the issue Nathan raised after the show yesterday was the willingness of Trump to...
Matt Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, to use executive orders, you know, stating how he will use executive orders to ban the illegal immigrants that have come in. And if you're so willing to, before even becoming the nominee, before even becoming the president, before even sitting in that chair, before even getting a chance to go to Congress, ready to take that pen and make law,
yep,
on this issue, what else are you willing to do without Congress to continue the chain of lawlessness that we see with this current administration from the last administration and the one before that? We see the progression as it continues to get worse.
Yep. Yep.
And would that change with if Trump were to get in? I mean, it's going to get worse regardless.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me that people can accept Trump's saying, well, we need to cull the internet. And I know that he refined that statement. But we, look, everything should be tested against, obviously, the scripture. But everything also politically on the political scene needs to be tested against the Constitution. If it's not Constitution, I'm not talking about the perverted Constitution with respect to the Supreme Court's decisions, or not decisions, but opinions. I'm talking about the Constitution as it stands, as it stands by law. So with Trump, you know, people, hey, we could have a benevolent dictator welcomed with open arms as a Hitler in 1930s because of the outside bad things that Germany was, you know, faced with, and Hitler was termed a savior, obviously looked upon as a savior. And could this happen, just a different set of skin or different skin, and you know,
let's not forget it would be. Hitler also got the economic part of Germany
at
the beginning of his regime up and running again. He took Germany back out of poverty, restored its manufacturing and job sector. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. He was held in high esteem.
Yep. Well, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't just, he was just some crazy villain that, you know, killed his way into power and took over. This was something that happened through a slow progression, increasing in insanity day by day.
That's very, very true. Very true.
All right, we have going to a break here in about...
Yeah, a few minutes. Okay, 2 minutes. I just want to read this quote here. Let's see here. Guess who said this? I assure you that I...
Eric?
I assure you that I never fail in any communication with Arab leaders, oral or written, to stress the importance of the spiritual factor in our relationships. I have argued that belief in God should create between them and us the common purpose of opposing atheistic communism. Now, let me read it one more time. I assure you that I will never fail in any communication with Arab leaders, oral or written, to stress the importance of the spiritual factor in our relationships. I have argued that belief in God should create between them and us the common purpose of opposing atheistic communism. You want to guess who said that? I'll save you the trouble. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, in a letter written to Edward Olson, or Elson, of the Presbyterian Church, dated 31 July 1958. The reason I bring that up is, listen to that statement. Or did you hear what I said?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Oppenheim, as I said, invented the concept of global jihad in order to convince the Ottoman Turks to side with Germany against Great Britain, France, and Russia in the First World War. Nazi Germany renewed that idea during World War II with the assistance of Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. That didn't work either time. Now, you see where we're going with this.
Folks, we're going to take your calls on the other side. We're going to hit some news as well. So we'll be right back after this quick break on this Thursday edition of the Hagman & Hagman Report. Go to HagmanandHagman.com and get the phone number. We'll put it up on the screen there, 844-769-2944. We'll be right back for hour number three. Stay with us.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.